Welcome to MSP 1337. I'm your host, Chris Johnson, a show dedicated to cybersecurity challenges, solutions, a journey together, not alone. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of MSP 1337. It is that time of the month where we have the fireside chat with Matt Lee. Matt, welcome to the show.
Man, it's awesome to be in my home studio, rocking my Gurkhan shirt.
Gurkhan.
Chat with you, man. So it's awesome.
And I'm rocking all the swag I got over the last couple of weeks. I got my ConnectWise cap on. I got my Showtech Solution sweatshirt, keeping me all warm and fuzzy.
That's awesome, dude. I don't need to
be fuzzy, but I'm warm.
Well, you're pretty fuzzy, I think.
A little bit. So we have been, originally, we started on this journey of like, we're going to tackle CIS controls and really focus on them based on the rumblings in the industry of like, I hate control three. Well, I hate control two. Like, actually, sure. No one's really said I hate the control, but we kind of went in this, started out in an order of like 1 through 6. We just kind of hit them one after another. And I think largely we could agree that going through the first 6 controls is, you really can't get out of doing it logically. If you follow that linear path, the other controls that come after you can be successful with. And I think largely it would be very hard to be successful if you haven't done those 6 controls.
I would agree.
Okay. So after that, I'm going to say it's kind of Pandora's box a little bit in regards to what's currently, you know, rising to the top, issues you're having in your organization, things that are coming up in the threat landscape that might make you target a different control.
And yeah,
totally. Last month we jumped all the way to 10. We talked about malware defenses because we were hearing the conversations and the criticality of the aligning of what CIS would say, like, hey, this is a critical control.
Sure.
Here's why. And the argument was like, well, I've already kind of done this, like in secure baseline configurations and like all this other stuff. And you're like, well, maybe, like, yes, maybe, like, but the reality is for them to bring it back as a control standalone says we didn't give enough one-to-ones without doing another control. Because it would have then probably been, you know, more than one thing being asked in one safeguard, right?
Yeah, and I want to add one piece of context to this 1 through 6 concept. I think you could do 1 through 6 out of order, right? Sheldon Phillips loves this, do 5 first because you already have identities. If you do that, you'll find the breadth expanding. And as you rotate back through those again, you will have to do 5 again, even in IG1, to properly apply it, if that makes sense, right? Like, what is an account is very much dictated to what's in control 2. What's an asset very much dictates how I'm going to have to do configuration management in 4. So you have all these interdependencies that come to play. Anyways, didn't mean
one,
to go.
One could argue it doesn't necessarily matter where you start, but recognizing that you have more work ahead of you if you start out of order.
That's the way I would say it. Yeah, that's the not Matt words way to say it.
Not Matt words, but like, like we could make this a not so clean episode and really say how we feel.
But yeah, fair. But anyway.
So we drew straws, picked binary numbers, and we still landed on not anything to do with either of those things. We landed on let's do control 7, continuous vulnerability management. And I think this is a great one to touch on with everything that we're seeing happening in the landscape today. I mean, let's be honest, we had narrowed it down to 2. So we're going to do 7, 8, 9, obviously we haven't done. And we're like, I'm like, screw 8. Who wants to talk about audit logging? But 7 and 9 are really interesting because both are hugely hot topics right now in the industry. And just for real quick, I'll just touch on one thing that came up in 9. Has anybody noticed, and just so you know, it's email and web browser protection, but has anybody noticed a huge uptick in mail getting sent to quarantine? Like if you're a 365 subscriber, there's been a huge uptick in stuff just suddenly starting to not get through as a result of what took place. I think it started about 3.5 weeks ago. There's been a huge uptick in spam just in general.
Well, more spam being a light definition of really a giant increase in the attack cadence, right? Of email and phishing attempts and things.
It's
like
a
that
war, too. not to belittle actual.
But
war,
I'm keeping us on control 7. You are not snaking us off to control 9 as much as I love it.
All right,
you did a good job, but we're back.
Let's get into.
I want to set the stage on control 7.
There you
right?
Go.
This set one it. Is I'm passionate about all the controls, but more so 7 really it touches a deep spot for me. And it's because It is the outward view of how little executives care and how little teams are empowered on the blue team to succeed. It just pisses me off, if I'm candid. And what I mean by that is,
are you ever candid?
Yeah, never. It never happens. But, you know, what happens is, when it says in this, it says develop a plan to continuously assess and track vulnerabilities on enterprise assets within the enterprise's infrastructure in order to remediate and minimize the window of opportunity for attackers. When you read into the why is this critical control, why is it control critical? Attackers have access to the same information and can often take advantage of vulnerabilities more quickly than an enterprise can remediate. That one statement makes my gut churn. And the reason is, it is the outward extensibility of a lack of care and a lack of drive and operational budget and operational speed and cadence for the teams that need to do this, whether it be MSPs or whether it be the small businesses or whether it be even large enterprises. So why? What does it matter? Let's look at Progressive's Move It, right? I spent an entire 7-hour trip from Denver to my hometown on the laptop, finding through favicon hash comparison in Shodan, right? We did a hash of the favicon for those Progressive servers, the page that actually takes you to the admin page where you can see what version is there. I then was able to compare that hash icon, that favicon on Shodan, and write a script through a few friends of mine and I to exfil those out so I can go check the site, see if they're still live, and then try to make contact on people if the version cannot be patched. And at that time, there was a list of what could not be patched. I found major cities in major states. I found major carriers that fly people. I found things like that and was notifying them. And so many people didn't have a way to deal with it, said they had already dealt with it and had not. It just broke my heart. And I think when you get down to it, why does it matter? A threat actor can scan that same Shodan favicon, write a script to exploit that server, and have access to all of Louisiana's driver's license files. That was part of the Move It challenge.
Right.
We've seen countless data breaches that have come from the inability to update a Move It server to a new version that had a patch. Let me just put this in plain English, right? This is about making sure if you have something that can have vulnerabilities, that does have patches, you need to both patch it, check that the patch worked, and somewhat externally check that the patch worked, right? From probative methodologies, like a threat actor would. Just because right. It says it's patched doesn't mean you're going to go, oh, look, still works. I still got in. You have to right. check. So anyways, I'm getting off my dang pedestal before I fall and break my neck.
No, I think that was really good. So, but let's rewind it a little bit, because I think there's one key piece that you glazed over, even though I think it's really important. And well, actually, there was more than one thing. One of them is leadership buy-in, right? Sure. Leadership doesn't care. Why doesn't leadership care?
Because they haven't been given an appropriate risk understanding. I think when we get down to it, they haven't been bought into the risk in a way that they can make an educated or uneducated but trusting decision, especially in the small to mid-sized business. You're still talking about one guy or gal that you're saying, hey, we need to take down the server and patch on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And if we have a high critical, we need to be able to patch it right now, no yeah. matter what operations. Can we get you to get behind that? Well, no, we need to wait a week for it. Great. In that week, you are done in this kind of cadence and operational speed of discovery if they happen to land on you, right? And it's that time window. Anyway, sorry. But
no, so let's unpack that for a minute, because there's more to it than just leadership being a bunch of, you know, whiny punk fill in the blank. The first one that comes to mind, the first one that comes to mind is you see this a lot, and I think this is tied to SecOps and IT ops, right? So there's a huge disconnect, I think, in a lot of organizations, especially when you have production environments, with who is responsible for what. And we were talking about this before we started the show, and we were really talking about, you know, which controls are most important, which controls are the most fun. And I think the reality is this is a sensitive topic, right? Yeah. And it's largely sensitive because the definition of vulnerability until proven vulnerable in the eyes of a lot of leadership who doesn't understand technology is that, well, you say it's vulnerable, but like it's been this way for 20 years.
Right.
So until it's exploited, yeah. you're, and then comparing us to something else in the industry is not fair. So I had one, an interesting one that might help elaborate on the story. Production servers cannot be taken offline for any reason because we have 4,000 right. customers relying on yep. that for their software. How do we move forward? And pause. I said, yeah.
The first thing my heart goes to as an engineer is then you clearly have not planned for this system in a way that is scalable. If there's no way for you to have nodes down, patching versions, a window defined, like that's my biggest gap.
Fair.
It started in the planning and failure, right?
Like, well, and it never starts out that way, right? So it's 2007, 2008. You've built this crazy kick-butt piece of software that everybody's consuming.
Yeah.
And you move along and you're maintaining that server and you're patching it. Like your application lives on top of whatever's there. And over time, the dependencies on that application continue to grow and grow and grow. And then you're like, well, why do we need to upgrade to a new Windows server to host this when the one that it's on works just fine, right? Until you get to a point where now the current server is 2019 or newer, and you're going, we can't just copy and paste anymore. We can't just forklift this anymore because the current infrastructure doesn't even have the libraries and dependencies on it that came installed on the one we had from 15 years ago.
And you know, the other thing that we get into that you're kind of raising is this combination of Control 7 and Control 16 in that conversation. Like that company wrote, made, built, borrowed, stole the software that they were using to host for some dependency of some drive function of their business. And yet in their application design phase, they didn't account for Control 7. They didn't account for the ability to deal with this infrastructural need.
Right.
And that is one of the things, without going off on a tangent.
16's custom software applications for anybody that doesn't know off the top of their head.
Well, and if you look at Control, I got distracted. But if you look at Control 16 talking about application design and come back to Control 7, right? When you move to things like function services or platform services as a developer doing these things, in the Cloud Companion Guide, which if you haven't read the Cloud Companion Guide in lieu of this, it is brilliant. It really helps you understand the just exposition of IaaS and PaaS and SaaS and what I'm responsible for and what I'm not and where does that shared responsibility need to start lying in that space.
Wait, if I built my company in the cloud, I should use that companion guide? Would that be a good idea, Matt? Okay,
I'm pointing at the screen for anybody that's listening to this.
And his nose at the same time.
And nose, because that's my shtick. Anyways, yeah, totally accurate. So let's get into the controls.
So let's real quick. I want to use this to go through the controls because I think this helps people with context to a story. Or safeguards. Yeah. So we actually had to pivot with these guys and say, okay, where are you at today in the development cycle? So it just so happened that they had built the product for current supported server. So great. So this is where we get into the next part of that. And I don't know how well it gets talked about in vulnerability management, but 100% it is recognizing that for vulnerability management, you better have a change management strategy in place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm not sure. Successful. I see that. And I point that out because I want to make sure as we go through seven that we highlight the importance of change management, because change management is really not well defined in the safeguards, but it's implied. And that's one of the things I kind of like about CIS is there are a lot of places throughout where it implies things that are actually quite obvious if you've ever learned like the ITIL model
Well, like 10.1, it just says have EDR, any malware. It doesn't say know how to use it or have any capabilities of dealing. It just assumes you have
right. Because it's 2023, right? Like 2022 when this came out, it wasn't like we're like EDR. Well, that hasn't been invented yet.
And I think the other thing to think about is if you are a practitioner, and I feel like that's what you and I would both call ourselves, at least in some former years and even kind of current models for different things. But, you know, when you think about it that way, you do have to take some liberty and understanding how these safeguards apply to you. There has to be a practitioner's eye to understand how these things have context, what's said, what's not said, what's implied. And it is a little bit of...
And you need accountability and ownership to go with it. This is where that was the last thing I was going to add with regards to leadership.
Back to your change management.
So leadership has to recognize that there's no perfect scenario that's always going to win for leadership and their plan from a business standpoint. Because at some point you have to recognize that there are risks that are so high that it doesn't matter what direction your business is going in. If you allow those risks to persist, you will eventually go out of business. And it will not be we got about 7 or 8 days and then we'll be going out of business. It'll be like, and it's over.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to remember that businesses exist to take risk. I take a risk I build this product, you will buy it and I will be profitable and successful. Those are things that are our risk. And so we have to
don't catch me on bad software. Don't catch me. If it's bad, don't catch me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just, it is just something to understand that an executive's job is to take risk. And that's why we have to say appropriate risk. We have to make decisions where that is the line, right? So
okay, let's dive in. So 7.1.
7.1, you know, establish and maintain a vulnerability management process. There are four IG1s in this safeguard set, right? And this one says, have a vulnerability management process for enterprise assets. Review and update annually or when significant enterprise changes occur. So this goes right back to your exact statement, Chris, of if you don't have a change management process, you're not going to know when significant changes occur that affect 7.1. And this is where people go down a bad road, right? This maybe someone stands up this driver's license ingestion move it server, and it's not necessarily discovered under the vulnerability management process because it's just running in Pete's office and nobody, right? I mean, I think that's the point you're making is you can't just let stuff happen. You have to know about it and plan through the rest of the teams that are responsible for it.
If your name's Pete, you're not getting an office. I'm just saying.
Yeah. It's always Pete. It's always not D's. I love this. Okay. 7.2. So we think about this, right? I don't know if you want to opine on this, but it's really have a process, have a plan. And that process does need to include having, you know, a date and a window defined, severity conversations. And we'll get into some of that stuff here in a bit. Anything to add to 7.1? There's tons done.
I think this is one that quite honestly, I think is pretty well defined across governments and other frameworks, right? So like, I don't know that there's any framework really, like I was just thinking about this the other day, like Cyber Essentials with, Essential 8 with Australia, CISA's done guidance on this. But bottom line is, you know, you need to do patch management. It needs to be an actual program. It's not just like, hey, Windows has got patches on Tuesdays, therefore we are good.
And most MSPs have all the base things necessary for this, right? They already have a patching implemented capabilities.
Yeah.
Using an RMM, native Windows patching or scripting. If you asked them the percentage of how many are actually trying to matriculate the patches and look at them from a security perspective and rank and scale them, what would you say your gut percentages of MSPs that are doing that right now?
That are ranking?
Not well, but they're at least ranking them. And when criticals come out, they have a plan for criticals.
I'd say, I don't want to be the bad guy here, but I think this is definitely where they go down the slide and have to start over in chutes and ladders. This is a low number.
I think it's actually shifting. And I think if you had asked
me that. Well, that's not the same as what it is.
Well, I think, you know me, I can't say things quickly. So no, I think 2 years ago, it was probably 20%. I think now we're closer to 50%. I think most of the MSPs listening today are at least going, oh my God, there's a critical that just came out from Microsoft or a critical. How many of them are then digging into criticals for every OS? Or I'm sorry, every line of business software their clients may have and checking that against the threat surface of what's out and what's been announced.
I would like to agree with you. Concept. I don't feel that optimistic.
Well, you guys listening, let us know, right?
If you I'd love to hear your thoughts because I think you're right about the, you know, see it in the news, you get the threat feed. Maybe you're subscribing to stuff out of the ISO, which I hope you
reactively,
are. Reactively. Yeah. And I think that's a fair targeted approach for certain things, but I was thinking more about the more generic side of this, like automated patch management, like where, no, we don't patch servers unless it's been 90 days. Like what?
Oh my God.
Right. Like, yeah. Or
that's
are we
going
doing,
away.
Yeah. So I, or, well, it is, but I think there's still, I think it's still more than 50% that are in that more of a legacy model of not being aggressive with patching.
Yeah. Well, you should be. And you can just tell them Matt said so. And
like, dude, I think they just heard it from the horse's mouth. I'm like, hey, I'm going to, like, my next episode is be like, if you listen to last week's episode, you'll know what Matt said.
No, 7.1, though, whenever you extend it out and think about all of 2.1, and two, right, when you think about that aspect of it, that's where I think MSPs probably have the biggest gap for their clients, right, is this, oh, my God, there's a critical vulnerability in this line of business dentistry software that you're running, and sure. I know, and I track. Patterson has this, and I just don't think that's the way it still works. In fact, even I would say for some of those softwares, they're still shipping CDs for you to plug in.
I mean, M&A agreements, I think to this day, still don't address those applications that we knew full well going into supporting that client that they had And we just kind of did like turn. Yeah. Oh, that's managed by the vendor. That's managed by somebody else. You know, they brought a laptop in that's got their, you know, X-ray software on it, but like, don't look because that's not our responsibility.
Yeah. And some of that does actually come into maybe having better defined SRMs and shared responsibility matrices that do set where that line is legally, to at least if you're already having to live that, at least have that in your legal agreements and things. But
I think what you just said right there, I mean, we need to go into the next safeguard or we'll never get there. But like you literally said shared responsibility matrix. I think that is the number one thing missing with most MSPs today. So I'd say that's at like a 5%. And quite that's honestly,
1-5%.
If you don't have that responsibility matrix, how do you define your run books? How do you define anything else you do in your organization if you don't have that present? Yeah.
That is the extension definition of where your extensibility function lies with your clients. And the better it's defined, I think the better we all heal. I think the better we all define our costs and what we should be charging. I think we all have a very different, anyways.
Do a tabletop exercise and find out real quick that you can't function because you have no idea who's responsible for what.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. We've played that game, right?
Like, yeah. Let's roll the dice.
It's crazy that this has to be said, but I do like the delineation, right? So the first one's a protect, right? Why is it a protect? Because I'm closing holes. I'm coming up with a process for closing holes. I know what I have to do from a blue team perspective. But 7.2 is a respond, meaning, right, being able to do something reactively to this.
And well, it says to remediate. It doesn't say remove.
That's correct. Well, yeah, but I think dependently on the risk, you might make a decision there, right? Because you might decide to not use that anymore. At some point, you might say, maybe we'll move to Dropbox instead of this move it server, or maybe we'll move to X. I don't mean Dropbox is the one, but you know what I mean.
Just it's tied to change, right? I think the important part about this is that you have a process to address change, whether it's done by automation or a physical choice being made to make that change. I think it's really important to note that without a remediation process, well, then kind of 7.1 is meaningless too.
Sure. Yeah, 100%. Great. Now I know how the attackers are going to kill me.
Winning. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, oh, I have a vulnerability management. I know. Look at this. They're going to go here.
We're screwed.
They're going to use Progressive to hop in and use Pwnkit. They're going to jump into our Linux course. You know what I mean? It's fantastic.
Yeah, and that rolls us right into 7.3.
It does. And that gets into the basics. And I hate saying that, but these are the basics. And I think actually MSPs get this probably 85% right. What because I mean
they have
RMM
tools.
They do. They have the RMM tools. They can do Windows. They can do Linux. They can do Mac, right? They can do Chrome OS through whatever that might be.
They might be using a WSIS server. Hopefully not.
Yeah, good. God bless. Maybe they have in the past, right? But they've dealt with this in some form or fashion pretty well. Where they think the gaps are for MSPs in 7.3 is what is an asset. And I know, like on my gravestone, I think it's going to say what is an asset. It's like becoming my coin phrase anyway. Like anyway,
herein lies a retired asset.
Yeah, no doubt, a flesh asset. But anyways, the thought process is they do well, but they don't probably cover a cell phone, right? Mobile, if it has access to data, they probably don't cover methodologies for OSs of IoT network equipment.
You're talking about the MSP.
Yeah, specifically here, right. And companies in general.
Well, and this gets into why BYOD, some of that stuff comes into play too, because you're like, well, you know, if we have that, then
let's break that down. There's a former company there's a former breach out there for this, maybe let's call it Smashword Manager company. And that Smashword Manager company actually found a, you know, human using a asset at home that was not defined as an asset well enough in 1.1, did not get dealt with based on your BYOD conversation, did not get dealt with in 7, and had a Plex server running that was 20 versions out of date that had an easy RCE or remote code execution.
Well, I'm just going to tell you right now, since I know which one you're talking about, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole because I'm going to say that that is one organization looking for a scapegoat because if it had been properly secured in the first place, this is like someone being left with local admin privileges on their laptop.
No, but you're not wrong. This is their home machine. And I think to your point, this isn't on him. This is on them. This is them not having 1.1. This is them not having 7.1. This is them not having 13, right? Network segmentation aspects of that. There's so many things that you could point to. And in fact, you're kind of giving me a Johnny foreshadowing because Sunil, you and I are going to do this exact game at our pre-day at Right of Boom next year. And we're going to break down modern breaches in failure's lens of these safeguards.
I love it. I hope I have the opportunity to be there for that. That sounds awesome.
Okay, but that the point takes is,
we now have a natural progression of safeguards that these are actually going to go pretty fast. The next one, so we just covered OS patching, and surprise,
and the breadth,
yeah, and surprise, 7.4 is all about application patch management. 100%. I think this is probably my favorite safeguard, and largely because of this is the one you hear the most excuses for. Well, we can't be responsible for knowing when Matt downloads and installs Qt FTP or Qt whatever. You can. Right.
Take away local admin rights.
What? We'll
those are all back in five, right? We talked and addressed.
But I mean, like, this is a foreshadowing right here for zero trust on applications.
Yeah, 100%. Well, no, let's not just get there. I mean, I think it goes back to
be good at patch management. Good at patch management with third-party apps. There are plenty of apps out there that I don't care how good you are at patching. Those third-party apps are still difficult to maintain, and in many cases, agreed, not even necessary because you already have an application
That's kind of my point. But let's take it back. If you're doing too well and you have an approved list of software and you have locked down the machine so that approved list of software cannot be violated easily by Matt, which does include SaaS, which does include, you know, CASBs and things like that, or ZT edges, or right to your point. And I think
this is like a spot check really to go back and look, right?
This is it. Yeah.
This is where you might go back to the beginning.
Yeah. And if you think about it, as you look at a cloud companion guide and you shift assets from a local software to SaaS, and you're having hopefully a functional shared responsibility matrix with that SaaS provider, then it's kind of on them to do that. At this point, right? The patching of the applications on their world, and the less and less that I own on my physical bare metal box,
right,
the less I am actually responsible for in that regard. And so that is kind of back to that move it versus a, let's call it SharePoint or something, right?
Sure.
Or other methodologies of delivery. I don't have to get Microsoft, bro, have you patched my SharePoint site yet?
Yeah, right.
There's a serious one out right now. Now they might lose my keys. Anyways, I digress.
But you know, that's a really interesting thing you bring up. Like, I had this with someone the other day. They're like, we host with a third party. I won't name the vendor, but they're a very popular vendor for hosting websites that hadn't patched Apache in like 4 years.
Yeah.
Like, it's a high probability of exploitation, and you're on an enterprise equivalent of web hosting server. Oopsie.
Yeah. That is exactly my point of a non-healthy shared responsibility, right? Where they are not doing it.
But sometimes it takes, if you see something, say something. To be fair, if we were talking about a data center and server farms, it is possible to have somebody miss something. And if no one says anything, it stays in that state.
Well, you know what? You just let us straight into
7.5.
A control in 14, right?
Oh, crap.
No, there's a control 14 in 14 that talks about train your users to look for patches missing.
That's true.
So
that's
foreshadow, but there is a safeguard. Anyways,
we'll do 14.
Yeah,
next.
So 7.4, correct. Application patch management. If you have an application that is being installed, you need to have change management to allow it to be installed. You need to have 7.1 address it, and you need to have 7.4 address it from an automatic patching if you can. And automatic can be a lot of things. That can be an automatic process that human automation, right?
Sure.
Where you're creating tickets for an automated process,
right,
in my mind. Talk me off a ledge here.
As Roost would say, that's not automation because that requires somebody to push a button.
Agreed. I do agree. And I think Roost is right on the nose of how I'd try to handle this, is make the buttons be more automatable through third-party RPAs, which is obviously what ConnectWise is talking about, which is obviously what Roost is talking about.
I mean, if you've ever played with Power Automate or If Then Then That, there's a lot of ways that this happens. This isn't like any one vendor. It's more of us recognizing that there are ways to streamline processes that don't involve human intervention. And when we do that, we reduce the probability of us doing something wrong.
So that's all the IG1s.
And that's also
patch your stuff.
Are you done with OPP? So that gets us into the remaining safeguards that aren't just
other people's patches. Did you just take us into
other people's
OPP
patches? That's right. Other people's patches.
So good. Okay.
So I'm glad you got me on that one. Sometimes I'm slow. Sometimes I have something that just comes out.
I hadn't had all my coffee yet. So
I'm 2/3. Okay. So there are 3 safeguards left, and it's funny, we don't just shift from IG1 to IG2. It's IG2 and 3 at the same time. These remaining safeguards are the safeguards that we talk about all the time, The first four, I think that, and what you talked about earlier, like what percentage of MSPs, I would say most MSPs would have a pretty well-defined program around 7.1 through 4. I'm not saying they're perfect at patching third-party apps.
They may not have it written down perfectly, right, but they will have it in action.
They put the RMM tool in. They're maintaining the tool. They're doing things that, you know.
You know when it breaks, kind of.
Yeah. They're doing a lot better job than the enterprise that doesn't have an MSP that has an RMM, right?
I actually proved that at GERCON with Jason Slagle. That's nice. Literally the throwback. We did a Nessus scan of an MSP first, when a client that Jason took over from another MSP, and it was horrible, horrible. And he actually pointed out how bad it was. There were like 18 major criticals. And then we bring up another one of a company, and we don't tell the audience what this company is. But this company is just one internal bloke working for a mid-end company that runs all their stuff. He's their Johnny Friday. They're still under 1,000 humans, right? And he does all the stuff. And theirs was 10,000 times worse. They had like 500 Raspberry Pis running on the oldest version out there. Like, I could DDoS their network from inside, right? Like, I could absolutely, like, so I mean, like, you just get each one of those doing some chatter, and man, it's over.
I was going to say, running SNMP public string and
brutal. And then we showed them that, hey, every even the worst customer they've ever taken from an MSP was 10 times better than Johnny working in a cubicle.
So you led into it, right? We're talking about internal scanning. You just literally like DDoS attack on the inside. Obviously, you would have done an internal scan to identify what you're going to do, you're attacking against.
And then pwned all of them and made them all bots for some.
I didn't do password spraying. I just used public and default, and I just went in.
Yeah, or like literally they were unpatched, and I have this easy RCE that can be executed in seconds.
Is that actually a DDoS attack, or that's just like the door was open, so I came in and had breakfast?
Well, it's just it would be a novel way of delivering my DDoS because of, you know, death by pie, right? Is the way I would call it.
So we covered internal. I think the next two. So, well, let's just, I want to jump to 7.7 for a second.
Automated vulnerability scans of internal assets is correct. Critical because you're looking at your entire protect surface, right? Attack surface is what you expose, and protect surface is what you have to protect, all of it, right? And attack surface is what you let threat actors have access to.
And to get to this one, you go back to one, and you know, 1.3 and 1.5 are all about how you're identifying assets that are either showing up on your environment that you don't know about, or affirming the assets that are there are in fact authorized or unauthorized. Would that be a fair, like, to jump to here? If you don't have that done well, this is like, I found vulnerabilities on the ones I scanned, but not the ones I didn't.
Yeah, especially when you start getting into effective network segmentation, where now you have to actually address legs of that network you can't see from the agent, or having to do methodologies that are collecting that per agent at each asset. And now if you don't have an asset, you know, tool, like let's say you're running a, you know, Nessus where you're installing it on every single machine, maybe, and doing that, you know, scan that's not network-based scan, but scanning on the actual asset for those maybe segmented devices. But yeah, you have tons of gaps here. And I think also when you think about it, you have just as many gaps in, I segmented off my printer network and I don't have the ability to scan it. Well, that printer network may not be as segmented as you think. There may be gaps. There may be a surface there. Granted, as you do good segmentation, the impact of this could control what is an asset. Because an asset has to be ability to touch and store data, right?
So, you know, and to add to this on the internal scan, you know, one of the things that comes up a lot when I was in the MSSP space was, I would not expect, you know, Matt's laptop on VLAN A to just suddenly be able to scan devices on another VLAN. But when I'm doing vulnerability scanning, I'm using a tool. Is scanning all of my VLANs, right? Like that would be dumb not to. And I think that when you look at, when we get further into the controls, you know, one of the
reasons, opening up a specific hole for that and such.
You have to, right? Otherwise you don't know, or maybe you run a separate scanner on the other VLAN. I've seen that before too. But what I would say is, what's interesting about this is when you get to pen testing, well, the idea here is that in a pen test scenario, I'm going to look for ways to laterally move across those different physical or logical networks and see what kind of privileges I can elevate myself to do bad things. If you aren't doing this, you should probably not jump to 18 ever, because it will likely be a very bad outcome.
Yep. Well, if you get back to like this, you know, kind of move it vulnerability challenge.
Sure.
It really does. It has a perfect poster boy for this conversation. An internal scan would find it. right? If they're looking at it, there should be an asset looking at that internal asset on a quarterly or more frequently basis.
Right.
But an external scan, they move the cadence up to monthly, right? And so in 7.6, they're saying, hey, and we won't tackle the SCAP compliant thing. That the protocol doesn't even talk about Windows 11 in most in the reference document.
I'll just tell you right now, I do not force people or tell people that they have to have a SCAP compliant tool, because in today's day and age, I don't know that it's worth it.
Yep. And it's not, like I said, they haven't updated some of this documentation to even
for speak a long time. Some of these.
But anyways, right. Yeah. So perform scans on a monthly or more frequent basis. If they had done that, they would have found an externally exposed progressive software MOVEit server that was out of date and vulnerable by validation. And that part of it is, you know, for me, is where the failure happens quite a bunch. And this is where people can get in some trouble as MSPs. You're going to scan, let's say, your client's web network. Let's say you're going to scan their website, not their assets that are internal where their data is, but this public site that they use. What if they're not able to get it patched? You're now going to sit with a vulnerability. How do you manage that? Are you going to manage having that conversation with your client over and over again? You should. If you go down that path, you should have a plan to be able to have that conversation as part of your risk conversations and risk register with that client. Yeah. And saying,
and hey, sometimes it's a difficult conversation. That can be a really difficult conversation because if you don't have experience with some of those things, like web application hosting, especially when you're using third parties that are not necessarily like your typical Microsofts or Googles and, you know, AWS, that's a hard conversation to explain, like, hey, your website is vulnerable. And they're like, well, we don't have any data on our website that's meaningful. Oh, but yeah, but there's a mail relay server sitting there that's telling people not just that they're you.
I do. So when you get those text messages that say, hey, you know, click on this, right? And it's a scam or malware now.
Right.
They're trying to do password dumping on Mac or iOS. Anyways, those, I like to go investigate them and dig into their infrastructure using like DNS dumpster or using cert.sh, things like that, and dig in where they are. And one of the things that I did was I sandboxed this last one, and I actually saw that it was coming from a poisoned watering hole at a website of an attorney, a prominent attorney in South Florida. And I called and I was like, hey, you're hosting malware on your website. Oh yeah, we're right in the middle of a breach right now. And everybody's back in the room talking about it. And I'm like, whoa. First, I would say, don't say breach. You do work in an attorney's office. It's probably be the best not to answer the phone and immediately drop out the B word. But second, you actually have a active vulnerability and an active malware campaign being run against your trusted site. And that's what they want, right? So people don't get that understanding of why it matters. I didn't mean to derail, but
no, I mean, like, you know, being able to articulate what that means, right? Like, I think there's a lot of things that, well, just go back to, if you built your MSP today, you'd build it all in the cloud, right? Who 100%. Wouldn't? But along those lines, how many MSPs today, and more so not MSPs, but their clients, believe that because it's in a Microsoft land or Google land or Azure land or AWS land, that they have convinced themselves that they don't have to do the same things anymore that they did when it was on-prem, which is partially true. It's different infrastructure. Sure. But
a different shared responsibility.
Different shared responsibility. And in many cases, the shared responsibility for the client and the MSP is not articulated, or is it clearly defined? It exists, but they aren't aware of it.
Yep. Yep.
And it's one more safeguard. Okay. 7.7. Ever. 7.7.
Swear to God.
Remediate
detected vulnerabilities. Can't believe this has to be a separate one. Yeah.
Isn't this like 7.2?
Yeah, like you would think so, but this actually goes on and says it. Like, no, for realsies. Yeah, like for Rizzle.
The first time we used to have in our traction
meetings.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, every time we were in our traction meetings, we'd have our goals, right? We'd have to come back in and say what we did in our tasks that we were going to get done.
Right.
And if you didn't do it in our meetings, we'd give you one faux Rizzle, two faux Rizzles. And if you got to three faux Rizzles, we were going to get serious about it. So this is where they're kind of like, no, really remediate those detected vulnerabilities.
But no, but really
tooling on a monthly. No, like seriously.
Like I was like,
update. And monthly probably gets you killed in today's day and age. 7.7 do this monthly probably gets you killed.
Right.
If you are out on a progressive software, you're already done.
This is the way I would break it down. And this is, you know, today, allow for automated patch.
Well, and you're talking about that 7.4 and 7.3, but I think what they're getting down to in 7.7 is this extensibility of those other things and other remediation methods, right? Like think about a WAF or a web application firewall in front of something because it can't be patched yet. Maybe that's the basis of 7.7.
Or
I understand
it says remediate detected vulnerabilities, which isn't always solved with a patch. It may be solved with a new, you said WAF. So it made me think of like, okay, we're adding a rule to the firewall in order to prevent this from happening. You know, log4j or like my favorite one was the paper cut vulnerability, where if you were exposed to the web and they sent the payload, it basically told every paper cut device that it found to essentially print you've been ransomed on every sheet of paper that was available in all printers across the entire network. You know, you might say like that's not real ransom in the sense of like taking all my data, but think about how many of those copiers hold anywhere from 4 to 10 reams or more of paper. Yeah. And they've all been printed out and are no longer usable. And you can't make it go away until you clear the paper cut server.
Some of the things that come to mind for me here in 7.7, if you're thinking about like, what is a real deep vulnerability scan doing? It's not always just checking to see if the software version is one that's listed by the manufacturer as clearing all known patches.
Yeah.
It can sometimes be fuzzing of directories. It can sometimes be trying to do path traversal. It can be sometimes like you may in some ways discover a vulnerability in software you're consuming that doesn't have a patch.
How like about Microsoft's SMB? You know, you now in Windows 11, that the new feature set that's by default completely turned off, and they don't recommend turning it back on for, you know, like, what is it? I'm going to use the wrong words here, but it's like your UNC path. So you no longer have like you can just start typing it in, have it auto show up. Right. Like that was one of the things that we saw back in the day was very useful, because then you're like, I think it starts with // fill in the blank, and then it would like show you the directory path that you were looking for. And we know that that's a vulnerability. That's not necessarily a coding problem or that the product was built poorly. It's more of that it's because that is easily exploitable.
And vulnerabilities can be things like a poor 4.1 and 4.2 and 4.3. Right. Because you, to your point, you could have SMB1 turned on. Right. That's a vulnerability. Right. That's a configuration.
It's also a feature.
It's also a feature. But the point being, I just want people to broaden their mind of what is a vulnerability. They can be self-created, right? Like I could deprecate TLS1 and yet somebody turns it on by using this wrong tool when they're trying to pass some FIPS test or something.
Right.
And now I've created a vulnerability that shows up on a vulnerability scan that needs to be remediated. So take, you know, I said 7.7 in jest, but the intention is it's really broader than you think.
Right.
This goes all the way back to how you would tune. 7.7 can often be how you would tune 4.
Yeah, the last thing I would say to this is this is also the last thing I would add to this is also about benchmarks, right? Like this is about knowing where you're at today and knowing that that is as an established benchmark, but that doesn't mean that there isn't going to be a new benchmark that you have to achieve to continue to maintain a level of what you might call secure state.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add to this for our, you know, 85-minute ramble?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry for that first for anybody listening. But no, I think 7 is one of those that people often write off and look at the title of it and go, yep, done.
Yep.
And if they really dig into it as MSPs, they're going to find there's decisions to be made.
For sure.
There's a shared responsibility. Like, how do you do well at patching? Your client has to give you a patch window. You have to have a shared responsibility, a definition of escalation of those patch severities, all those things. So it's just
and it
a
needs
little harder
to be documented. You need to be able to prove it. Like, you know, things are going to happen. If you can't prove it, it didn't happen, right? Like, as they say, if it's not in ConnectWise, it didn't happen.
Yeah, 100%.
All right.
This is definitely trade.
For those of you listening, this has been an episode of MSP 1337 Fireside Chat with Matt Lee. Thanks. Have a great week.